From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our foreign policy contributor weighs in on the deteriorating situation in Iraq.
And I don't think we should welcome any brutal dictatorship. It's hard to see controlling the area, at least over the short term.
Then why Milwaukee businesswomen are having difficulty serving on company boards of directors.
Now, you can't say lack of awareness is the issue. You can't say that you're not aware that women aren't leading these companies in large numbers. Now they're looking at, well, maybe companies don't know of women that they could appoint to these boards.
The Public Policy Forum points to some success stories in local government.
Cooperation, the sharing of services, different levels of government working together on common projects to save taxpayer money is really an area that still has a great deal of untapped potential.
And we'll catch up with MSO Concertmaster Frank Almond. Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said yesterday that U.S. military action could come before a new government is chosen in Iraq. Kerry's words come amid a violent uprising by the Sunni militant group called ISIS. The fighters have now seized all border crossings on the western border of Iraq and are working to capture more territory in the absence of an effective defense by the Iraqi government. Meanwhile, many foreign policy analysts caution that what the U.S. does in reaction to the worsening situation in Iraq will have consequences across an already unstable region. Art Sear is our regular foreign policy contributor. He's Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy at Carthage College in Kenosha. He talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about how the situation in Iraq unraveled so quickly.
The government is very weak and also quite repressive. Maliki has, as every one of your informed listeners probably knows, been extremely self-defeating in the sense that he hasn't been willing to reach out to the Sunni population, which was previously in the saddle with Saddam Hussein. He's inept in that sense, and consequently there is pressure, some of it quite vocal, including leaks from the Obama administration that they would like to see someone else in charge.
It seems there are some who have said that there was really an opportunity to build some bridges in that country that have just not been built.
Yes, that's right. Given the intensity of the sectarian conflict and given the legacy of the American military invasion, which I have believed consistently was a significant strategic mistake, that even that might not repair things. I'm not sure it's possible without the most brutal kind of dictatorship. And we've destroyed the infrastructure used by that dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. And I don't think we should welcome any brutal dictatorship. It's hard to see controlling the area, at least over the short term.
Well, right. I was just going to ask, you know, what is the likelihood that anybody could be in a leadership position in Iraq and, you know, be all things to all sides?
That's extremely well put. Andrew Bacevich, someone I respect, a West Point graduate with combat experience in Vietnam and significant academic credentials, direct involvement in the first Gulf War, where he served. Tragically, his son was killed in combat in the Iraq War. He's drawn a parallel on public radio with Vietnam in 1963, when the increasingly repressive Catholic regime of Ngo Dinh Diem and his brother-in-law, Ngo Dinh Nu, the war was going badly. They were creating a good deal of isolation for themselves. A lot of President Kennedy's very brainy advisors urged him to get rid of President Diem, and our ambassador, Henry Cabot Lodge, did help orchestrate a coup in which the Diem brothers were killed. That only led to an unraveling of events, a succession of rather weak generals as dictators. It was a serious mess, became even more serious. I would be extremely cautious about doing anything, including sending in American advisors, which will reinforce our sense of commitment. I doubt that 300 even very good special operations types and experienced military men can make much difference in this situation.
Well, and of course, the name ISIS probably would not have registered much with Americans at all a month ago. And now, you know, you can't turn on a news channel without hearing a reference to this group. What do you see as the ultimate threat here?
the ultimate threat is increasingly extremist and grandiose in terms of visions and ambitions, violent Islamic extremism. It remains a very fractionated population of extremists. As, again, our listeners probably are well aware, al-Qaeda has disowned ISIS formally and publicly because they are such an extreme movement. But they are men who, from almost literally every part of the globe, who have been drawn to this vision and who have proven themselves effective in combat.
Well, so frankly, should it be up to the U.S. to step in at this stage? I mean, there are some who are saying, some senior officials in the Obama administration who were saying, you know, military action might need to take place before a new government forms.
Yeah, I think that would be a serious mistake and misguided. And I think, at least since World War II, it's been kind of congenitally characteristic of American policy officials, and one important measure of presidential leadership is the degree to which presidents are able to guide these situations. I think during the brief Kennedy administration, President Kennedy actually did a commendable job of dealing with a wide range of foreign policy challenges after the Bay of Pigs disaster, right after he took office. Osama bin Laden, who remains an important posthumous factor in this movement, President Obama cited in his State of the Union quite rightly that bin Laden's ultimate ambition was to draw the U.S. into a costly and very counterproductive conventional war in the Middle East or Southwest Asia. And in that sense, things have played out in a way that can only be gratifying to those who are committed to that very extreme and very ugly movement. I'm not certainly defending bin Laden. I'm not defending everything about President Obama. I do think that it's important to keep the wider strategic picture in mind. And in that sense, we should consider what we do in Iraq in the context of other developments in the region.
Well, let's talk about those developments. You know, there's some who are talking about a spillover effect. And frankly, we and a lot of other countries already have our hands full when it comes to other parts of that very same region, say Syria.
That's right. We have a lot of tools beyond direct military intervention. In the case of Syria, the announcement was made today, and the U.S. has played an instrumental positive role in this regard, that Syria continues to live up to its formal declaration and commitment to destroy weapons of mass destruction, in this case chemical weapons. And the U.S. is playing, quite rightly, the central role in getting rid of those weapons. Richard Nixon, in policy terms, deserves a great deal of credit for effective strategic leadership, including mitigating considerably the impact, strategic impact, of the U.S. defeat in Vietnam in the mid-1970s by anticipating that and opening the door to China in 1972-73. It's that kind of wider vision that I think we need, and I would hope any administration, whether it's Republican or Democrat, would pursue.
Meanwhile, this all has pushed Ukraine off the front page, but there is still instability in that part of the world. A fragile ceasefire has been agreed to at least through the end of this week, with the hope being that this will open a window during which some negotiations over the future of eastern Ukraine could take place. Is this an optimistic sign?
I think it's certainly not bad news. The degree to which we can, as Churchill said, jaw-jaw rather than war, that's always preferable. The degree to which we can get the parties to negotiate is all to the good. I'd be surprised if the Red Army overtly invaded Ukraine, but they did do that in Georgia in 2008, another independent state that used to be part of the Soviet Union, after extreme provocation from us, in my opinion. Historically, Russians, including the Soviet regime, have been cautious about using massive force overseas, but they are extremely anxious, if not paranoid, to have friendly regimes on their immediate western border. And I think we must keep this in mind in foreign policy moves. It's another area where I don't think military options are very viable or useful for us, especially directly. But we have lots of other leverage. John McCain, in a perceptive and lucid moment. He talks almost constantly nowadays, but he was quite accurate when he mentioned that that Russia is really a gas station. That's what they have, is natural resources plus nuclear weapons and a very tough, experienced military. insofar as we can use a combination of economic carrots and also sticks against Russia, I think we can serve as a source of restraint. I think overall the administration has handled things very well. Number one, John Kerry is an extremely hardworking, very engaged Secretary of State. Number two, we're working to put the NSA spying stupidity behind us. Angela Merkel and Germany remain pivotal and particularly important to us in dealing with Russia and Eastern Europe generally.
Art Sear, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Art Sear is a professor of political economy, world business, and director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's our regular foreign policy contributor, and he spoke with Mitch Tyke. Coming up next, why Milwaukee businesswomen are finding it tough getting to the top leadership positions. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The Milwaukee Business Journal each year recognizes women leaders from many sectors of the community, all of whom have risen to play prominent roles in what they do. But recently, the newspaper looked at whether women are having success rising to the highest echelons of the business world, corporate boards of directors, and executive leadership roles. The answer was, in Wisconsin, generally not. Reporter Allison Bowder and assistant editor Stacey Vogel Davis compiled a series of articles that appear in the latest print edition of the paper, with new content being added this week. They joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in the studio, and Vogel Davis offered a snapshot of the state of things for women corporate executives in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee Women, Inc. is a group that has looked at this issue for years, and their focus specifically is the number of women on serving on the boards of public companies and also in the top C-suite of public companies. So they've issued an annual report for more than a decade now. And at first, it really looked like Milwaukee was making progress between 2003 and 2011 or so. You know, the percentage of women serving on boards rose from 9% to 14%. The rate of women executives didn't rise quite as fast. But then in 2011, it kind of seemed like we hit a wall, and the rate has stayed flat since then. So there's all kinds of reasons why, and that's kind of what we were looking at.
Well, and there was some concerted effort beginning in about 2003 to do something about it. So is this evidence that that effort was a success, at least for a while?
What we're seeing is those years that things kind of stalled out was about the time of the recession. So it was when companies were a bit preoccupied. You might say they aren't making a priority of introducing something new to the company. They're just trying to stay afloat. And so that was when we saw things kind of stall out. And now I think, you know, what we're finding with this story is that the numbers, you know, as far as Milwaukee Women Incorporated was concerned, those numbers weren't enough on their own, so they're making a more concerted effort. They're going to those companies and talking to them about what they can do to change things.
Well, and there are some who might say, well, there are still a lot more women in the workforce than there used to be, and more women in supervisory roles. What real difference does it make whether there are women on boards of directors or in the very top positions at companies?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, you know, there are also people who say as these women are in the workforce, they're naturally going to rise up through the pipeline and, you know, become the top person in the organization. And, you know, we've seen that a little bit, but women have been in the workforce for a few decades now, and it still hasn't happened. We're still not seeing women leading companies on the same level as men. And it's also an important issue in its own right. When it comes to women leading companies or women having an equal say in these companies, women bring different perspectives. You know, they as mothers or, you know, women in general tend to have different thinking processes than men. They might focus on different things or prioritize different things. And, you know, studies have shown that companies tend to do better when they have some gender diversity in their leadership.
Well, and so what did some of the companies you spoke with say about their interest in or ability to diversify their boards?
So what we're hearing from Milwaukee Women, Inc. and from a lot of these top executives is that it's a matter of what they called intentionality. It's a matter of saying, okay, we have an open position coming up. We want to have a person of color or a woman filling this spot. And it was one where, again, that maybe that intentionality wasn't there, you know, around 2011. But we have several companies that were what Milwaukee Women Inc. called a 00. No women executives, no women on the board. And they had recent openings, and they made that choice and went out and found that there was a big pool to draw from. There's a lot of talent that kind of, you know, had the qualifications, had that kind of bottom line value, and also brought that diverse perspective.
You actually name names of some of these 00 companies in your piece.
Yeah, one of the companies that we talked to actually was Roundy's, because we actually came up with four companies in the Milwaukee area that are one of these 00s. Three of them were manufacturers, and one of them was Roundy's, the grocery company. And that's been one that people have kind of asked about for years as they look at the Milwaukee Women Inc. report. It's, you know, well, women are the primary grocery shoppers often in the family. So why can't they get any women in their leadership? So Milwaukee Women Inc. looked at that as well. And they just recently, this month, met with some Roundy's leaders and talked to them about this issue too. And what they learned and what I learned in my reporting was, you know, it can be difficult to get women to rise up in a company like Roundy's because so many of their leaders come from the grocery stores. And an assistant manager or store manager at a grocery store is expected to work odd hours, nights, weekends. It's not necessarily family friendly, and it's not necessarily something that women are looking for. So they've said that they're looking at their pipeline, trying to make some changes maybe to the schedules that are expected of these assistant store managers, or looking at ways that they could bring people up through the corporate ranks instead of through the store ranks. And they've also gone on the record now. The CEO has said that the next time that a board position opens up, he would like it to be a woman or a person of color.
Well, and so what are these other groups like Milwaukee Women Incorporated, what are they doing to try to spur more action among these companies that are out there who maybe have not diversified as much in the past?
Right. So what they concluded was, again, that those numbers alone maybe weren't enough to move that needle. So they are, you know, like Stacey said, they're going directly to them. They're sitting down with those upper leadership and they're saying, OK, first, we want to listen. You know, what kind of challenges are you running into? Is it, you know, is it pipeline? Is it a lack of women who have the qualifications for this specific board position? You know, what is it? And then how can we work with you? And so they're kind of identifying those specific problems and then, you know, offering resources and ways to kind of get to that solution.
It's almost kind of taking away the excuses one by one. I mean, if you look at what Milwaukee Women Inc. did in the beginning was they released this report and their philosophy was, you know, if it gets measured, it will get changed. And that worked to some extent. And now, you know, you can't say lack of awareness is the issue. You can't say that you're not aware that women aren't, you know, leading these companies in large numbers. So now they're looking at, well, it's the resources, you know, that maybe companies don't know of women that they could appoint to these boards or ask to be in their top leadership. So they also have a network of that. Milwaukee Women Inc. is part of a national network that actually looks at this issue. And so they have access to other markets that might have women who would be great candidates for these roles. And then they can provide those lists to the companies. So now they're looking for what those challenges are and seeing how they can meet each one.
Do the groups like this have a kind of a target for the number of women or the percentage of women that would be appropriate to be in these positions? Is it 25%? Is it 50%?
They don't necessarily have a target. What they have been doing is identifying those companies that are over 25% or over. And we do have several, and again, coming down to intentionality, companies that are in that position. Harley-Davidson is one of them. Another is Journal Communications Incorporated is actually doing very well. It's, I believe, over 33% on both sides, the executive and the board.
And you know what's interesting is actually, as we talk to some of these women themselves, we talk to some of our women of influence winners who are some of the, you know, biggest leaders in the community, whether it's nonprofit or corporate or what have you. And, you know, some of them are saying, you know, you're not necessarily going to see parity. You know, we might not get to the 50-50 level, and that could be okay. I mean, some women want to take a step back from their careers, you know, would like to stay home with their children. You know, some men would too, but you see it more often in women. And for them, they might not want to rise to that top level, and that's okay. But, you know, it needs to be better than it is now.
Well, and there are some women you quote who actually bristle at the idea of a glass ceiling. There are some who say that women just need to be more outspoken and say, this is what I want.
Yeah, it can be an issue of, you know, women not standing up for themselves. And that was one of the things we found in the story, you know, talking to the experts as well, is that it has to come from both ends. It has to be the companies making an intentional effort to increase the diversity, but it also has to be the women standing up and saying, I can do this. I would, you know, I would like companies to look at me as a potential board member.
Well, and let me ask you this. As two women reporters covering this story, did you feel like your sources might have responded to you in a particular way because of your own gender?
I do think that maybe some of the companies – defensive isn't the right word, but certainly they were very quick to assure me, oh, you know, this isn't tokenism. We're hiring these women because they're qualified. And whether or not that was because I was a woman interviewing them, hard to say. But, you know, they may very well have responded a bit differently.
And it's also kind of – you know, it is a cultural thing. You know, as I was talking to the women of influence, you know, it just becomes I think sometimes for them, you know, that I think they thought they could speak a little more freely to another woman about the challenges they're facing. And they were very open about, you know, how this affects their family lives and what their priorities are and what they think. And sometimes it does help to have someone else who's in that position talking to them.
Well, Stacey Vogel-Davis, Allison Barr, thank you so much for sharing this. And we'll look forward to the next installments.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mitch.
Stacey Vogel-Davis is assistant editor and Allison Bauder is a reporter who covers small business, startups, technology, finance, and education for the Milwaukee Business Journal. They spoke with Mitch Tyke, and their coverage of women in executive leadership in Milwaukee runs all this week in the online edition of the publication. Well, usually when we focus on government policies, we look at what went wrong. Coming up next, we chat about what went right, at least in local government. So stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us today. There are a lot of stories of local government in action, and many of them are negative. There's the flap over the potential future downtown arena, the controversy over control of the county's mental health system, and many other narratives that have cast a negative light over the state of government. And the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum has done research that holds a magnifying glass up to the sometimes ill-advised decisions made by legislators. But this week, the nonpartisan organization is trying to shine a spotlight on examples of government done right, as it holds its salute to local government. Rob Henkin is president of the forum. He tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about what the group is setting out to accomplish with this event.
We actually have a very strong story to tell, Mitch. We feel that even though it's just one morning in the course of the year, that it's very important to recognize that there are innovative, outstanding things going on in the halls of city government and county government and local school districts throughout our region that don't typically get much notice, that we need to celebrate, that good government benefits all of us and the men and women who are working hard and working innovatively and recognize their responsibility to the taxpayers, at least for one morning, deserve some applause.
Is there something to the idea that when government is going well, we don't notice it, and when government is going badly, we do?
I think there is. I don't want to pick on you and your colleagues in the news media, but clearly, and you know, forever there has been a watchdog role, not only for the news media, actually for the Public Policy Forum as well. And it's our duty and responsibility to report to people when things are not going well, when dollars are not being allocated efficiently and appropriately, when there is corruption, et cetera. So that's important. But yes, a good news story when an accountant has developed a way to save his or her government $10,000 annually, that's not the type of thing that gets reported in the news media.
This is the classic case of, you know, you guys never report on the planes that land safely.
Exactly. And again, for most of the time, government is functioning pretty darn well, both locally and at other levels.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the themes that come through or that show through the awards that you're giving at this event. And there seems to be kind of a broad theme about intergovernmental cooperation that's represented in a single person who's being honored and a group of entities that are being honored.
Yes. So we do give a group award every year for intergovernmental cooperation. And this year, that award is going to a series of local governments and actually a public university for the Innovation Campus Project in Wauwatosa. And that's just a classic example where there had to be people rolling up their sleeves from a variety of different levels of government. In this case, the city of Wauwatosa, Milwaukee County, the state of Wisconsin. They worked very closely with the UWM Real Estate Foundation. Foundation. And there was certainly some controversy surrounding this proposal and the extent to which it was appropriate for that site and the extent to which there might be some environmental issues. But in terms of, again, we're not as interested in the merits of the project as the example of different levels of government with different interests working together toward a common purpose and getting something done.
As somebody who has been around local forms of government for a while, is intergovernmental cooperation more important than it used to be, given the shrinking resources that local governments themselves have?
I think it absolutely is, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. When we look out, and the Public Policy Forum has reported a great deal, and you've had us on the show to talk about the fact that we have some revenue structures in terms of how we're financing local government and school district activities that are very challenging. When you look away from the revenue side to the expenditure side, you have to ask yourself, what can we do to try to provide and perhaps even enhance existing service levels in different areas without having access to greater revenue to support them? And cooperation, the sharing of services, different levels of government working together on common projects to save taxpayer money is really an area that still has a great deal of untapped potential. And so we really want to celebrate it when it's occurring on a responsible basis.
Where does Kevin Schaefer fit in this conversation?
So Kevin Schaefer is the winner this year of perhaps our most distinguished honor, which is the Norman N. Gill Award for Individual Excellence. And so that goes to an individual who really, from their day-to-day working and achievements, really rises to the top. And Kevin is this year's recipient. And while I am not a judge, we actually have a panel of judges, several of our trustees, as well as a couple of award winners from the previous year. I can tell you that the judges this year really cited Kevin's work to bring different governments together around the issue of watershed management. And clearly, the way he goes about approaching the business of addressing clean water issues, if you're a municipality that is worried about the condition of your river that is flowing through your municipality, you can't solve that problem alone. You have to look at this from a watershed-based perspective. And Kevin has just been remarkable in his ability to bring together leaders of different governments throughout the region to work together on water quality.
And for people who don't necessarily know Kevin's name, he's the director of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Sewerage District. And a few years back, it would be difficult to imagine that you would be honoring the MMSD for its leadership in just about anything.
You're right. We had the so-called sewer wars back in the 1990s. That was over the issue of who was going to be charged and how for the deep tunnel project. There was a lot of acrimony surrounding that. And that has disappeared. Was Kevin solely responsible for that? No, but I think certainly his collaborative approach has been very effective. And today it's nice that we don't have sewer wars going on.
This is not necessarily intergovernmental cooperation, but public-private cooperation. An example of that you are honoring is something that many people, at least in the western suburbs, would recognize because they spent a lot of time there over the summer.
Yes. So we are recognizing with our Public-Private Cooperation Award this year the Milwaukee County Parks Department and a friends group that formed to reopen the Hoyt Park Pool. So this is a county pool that has been around since the old Conservation Corps days after the Great Depression in the 1930s. The pool was closed by the county 5-6 years ago. There were some substantial maintenance issues. The county felt that the attendance didn't justify making the investment in fixing the pool, and so they closed it. Well, a private friends group formed, got together, worked with the county, raised money to not only rebuild the pool but turn it into more of a water park type of facility. They now are the operator of the pool. The county, for its part, has made a series of improvements to Hoyt Park, the area surrounding it, so that it all meshes together very well. And now we have this outstanding regional facility that, again, has resulted from efforts by both the private sector and the public sector in this case to work together.
That is not necessarily a story of technology, but you do recognize a number of entities for their use of technology in the current context.
Well, as you know full well, data-driven decision-making is very important to the public policy forum. It's something that we try to advocate for among all areas of local governments and in school districts. And so, yes, we actually have a couple of awards. One is for innovation in financial management. Another is for effective use of data and technology. This year, in terms of financial management, the Village of Shorewood is getting that award. It has a very intensive long-range financial planning process. It has developed a long-range plan and then uses the data that is associated with that plan and the metrics they've established to guide decision-making on fiscal issues throughout the course of the year. The Pewaukee School District is getting our award for effective use of data or technology. They use a balanced scorecard approach where they are collecting data on all facets of academic achievement and learning and using that to actually promote better practices in the classroom.
Some interesting and fairly undertold stories of local government. Rob Henken, thanks for sharing them with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Rob Henken is president of the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum. He spoke with Mitch Teich. The organization's 22nd annual Salute to Local Government is Wednesday morning at the Italian Conference Center. There's a link to more from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then chat with MSO Concertmaster Frank Almond. You are listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. The MSO's concertmaster Frank Almond made headlines in January when his Lipinski Stradivarius violin was stolen from him after a concert. Almond was tasered and the rare instrument was missing for a few weeks before it was found and returned. During that same time, the symphony itself was in a do-or-die situation regarding its finances. They needed $5 million in a very short amount of time to keep the symphony running. Fast forward a few months, and both stories have a happy ending. The symphony raised the funds and is preparing for its next season, and both Almond and the Lipinski Strad suffered no long-lasting ill effects. Almond spoke to us recently in front of an audience from the sixth floor of the University Club. Frank, welcome back to Lake Effect. It is a pleasure to have you on the show again.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I was listening to, of course, to your talk downstairs, and I wanted to start with... We're talking about the way the arts in Milwaukee are working into the community and the way classical music is finding a new way to address its audiences and to deal with its audiences. And you were talking about how you had found that the culture could be stiff and sort of elitist. What do you think classical music needs to do to kind of erase that and to make people realize that this is for everybody?
I don't think there's any one answer to that. First of all, I think it's community-based. I think the solutions to the things you bring up are different in every single community. So I'm talking about what I, you know, some ideas that might happen and at least concepts that might be considered here that would work. To the term elitist, that always has different kinds of connotations to me, personally, because it's always seen as a negative when, in a way, what we do is actually sort of elitist. It is. It's performing really great music live on a really, really high level. Now, if you consider the term elitist to be exclusionary, that's a problem. And I think that's really what orchestras and a lot of performing arts institutions are facing. Somehow we're perceived as being up in these ivory towers and you have to do this and that and X, Y, and Z before you'll appreciate all of our knowledge and what we're... Like, we're doing you a favor by playing a concert. Which is ridiculous, because what we're really doing is presenting great art to anybody that wants to see it. And just like when you walk into the art museum here and you either see the building or see a painting that somehow grabs you or resonates with you in some particular way, even if you don't know anything about that painting, there is an element of elitism there just by virtue of the skill it took to make the painting or to build that building. You know, there are parallels there. I think that how, just back to the protocols and the formats of how orchestras present themselves to audiences, I think that's really critical and kind of what we're talking about.
How could that change? How could they change those protocols?
Well, I think a lot of them are changing, actually, in terms of venues we play in terms of the kinds of programming we do, in terms of the actual format of a concert, in terms of even something as simple as what the orchestra is wearing, which I fight this battle constantly because I can't stand wearing tails. I mean, I just don't like tails. And I have to go work in tails, you know, like another person has to wear a business suit. There are purists who believe that orchestras should be wearing tails when we play a subscription classical series. My argument is that no one in the world wears tails anymore, including Prince Charles maybe once a year, or maybe the White House inaugural ball or something like that. Orchestras wear tails for a very specific reason. In the 19th century, everybody wore tails when he went out. That's what it was. We don't do that anymore. 50 years ago, men wore hats all the time. And some people wear hats now. But, you know, you don't see 100 people walking down the street wearing fedoras anymore. I think that kind of thing needs to be rethought because it's yet another way of separating us from the people that come to listen to us and to have that experience. You know, it's really about the experience, I think, from the moment you walk into the door until when you leave. And the more obstacles there are to people connecting to what you're actually doing, the harder it is. And the dress code is just one thing. And I'm not suggesting we should show up in jeans and T-shirts. I'm just saying there are alternatives to wearing tails. And a lot of orchestras around the world have figured that out. So, and we've played around with different ideas, but we're not quite there yet as far as I'm concerned. Playing in other venues also. We have a very successful series with the MSO playing at Collectivo locations on Monday nights, for example. Little chamber music groups. People love it. My chamber series plays in smaller venues, and we have a little bit more, not casual approach, but I'd say a little bit more inviting approach just by virtue of the intimacy of those venues. So the more of those barriers that can be broken down, the better.
You talk about chamber music, and of course, the very intimacy of that, the fact that you can see all of the musicians, that you know, people aren't hidden, that as an audience member, you are closer to mm-hmm. the musicians most of the
right.
time, and you can actually see people sweat and breathe and mm-hmm. and actually do the physical work of making the music that you're hearing. I think that helps too. It's like being able to see the person running, mm-hmm. you know, makes a difference than if you're like watching it on a television camera
right.
way back. If you're down right on the track, that's a whole different experience.
Right. The big point is your level of connection with what's going on any of those subjects that you just mentioned. Now, the Marcus Center, our hall, does not lend itself to an audience being completely connected with what's going on the stage. That's just sort of a design fact. There are concert halls in the world that do that. You go to Carnegie Hall, you go to the Musikverein in Vienna or the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, and you feel this immediacy from the musicians. They're not very far away, and there might still be that wall to a certain degree between performer and an audience, but it's much less. So part of it's a design factor, but I think there are ways to address that as well, not just pulling the orchestra closer to the audience, but playing in places like the Pabst was a huge thing for us this season, examining other venues where you have more of an immediacy and are still able to do orchestra concerts and not just chamber music concerts. And in a town like Milwaukee, another big factor is that almost all the musicians in the orchestra live either in the city or very close by. there's a couple, I think, that live more towards Chicago and come in all the time. These are people that are around going to the store and paying taxes and teaching your kids lessons, and they're a huge part of the fabric of the community. And a lot of them are close with our board members. A lot of them have kids in school together with children of our patrons. There are huge connections on those levels as well that I think have made a big difference in this particular area.
Well, I think it made a huge difference in the fundraising campaign that just was completed.
Absolutely, yeah.
I don't think that would have happened in a place where the orchestra members weren't living in the community that they played in.
Yeah, I totally agree. I also think that was also a question that had been on a lot of people's minds, just the question meaning, how much support will this community at large give this institution? And that was a question that I think was floating around for a long time that nobody really had to ever ask. And honestly, I think a lot of people were nervous about it once we had to do that. But there really was no choice. I mean, it was a sort of sink or swim situation. Happily, the response was probably more robust than anybody expected. It was really heartening to me to see that and to have people talking to me about giving an extra $20. You know, these are not the Rockefellers you're talking about. There are people stopping me in the supermarket saying how much they love the orchestra. You know, and they really don't want things to change, and they want it to survive, and their kids are going to go, and, you know, they came through. It's amazing. It's fantastic.
One of the changes that happened, and I don't know how much this change was in these final concerts, more recent concerts, but is the smaller orchestra in place now, or is that coming as part of the retooling?
My understanding is that there's a sort of transformation happening, and I don't know at what pace or at what phase that has occurred yet. We typically have a normal amount of retirements every year. That may be more a question for Mark Niehaus, our CEO. There's no question the orchestra is going to get smaller, and that was kind of part of the agreement that we came to, and there are definite pros and cons artistically for that. We may have to just be smaller in terms of numbers on stage and adjust the programming accordingly, but that was kind of the Faustian bargain that where we are right now. I think it's doable. Ado believes it's doable that we can still stay artistically viable, at least in the short term. I would hope that maybe if a few seasons like that go by, or a couple of seasons go by where we're basically playing with smaller numbers on stage, that at some point we can get back to more of the core repertoire that we're known for, that has, you know, larger forces and can do a Mahler symphony once in a while.
Mahler or Bruckner or the bigger Brahms or that sort of thing.
And it's not like next... I was actually really shocked when I saw what they were planning for next season in terms of the some of the pieces that we're going to be able to do with the forces involved. Now, some of those were... I guess we're going to bring in a couple of extra musicians just from, you know, on a weekly basis or something. But some of them were actually playing pieces with just a smaller orchestra that will be leaner and probably more powerful. In some cases, more historically accurate. You know, we're used to doing Beethoven symphonies with a Beethoven orchestra that's probably much larger than Beethoven envisioned most of the time.
Yeah, what is the Beethoven? It was like five...
Well, it was getting bigger. It depends on when a Beethoven's life you're talking about. But certainly by the time of Mahler, you know, you had 130 people on stage, and that was nothing. Forget about Berlioz or Wagner. I mean, it was just, you could have 300 people up there, and the more the merrier. And not necessarily to me. But there's plenty of stuff written in the 19th century, the late 19th century and early 20th century, for sure, that we could make a case for some works of Strauss, even. I think one of Ado's great strengths is adaptability and creativity in programming. And we're in the position we're in, and we're going to make it work.
I want to talk a little bit about technique and craft. Take me inside like a section rehearsal. I've never played in an orchestra. I've played music and I've played chamber music, but I've never done orchestral work. So what is it like when you sit down with the violins in the first section? You're working on whatever you do. How does a rehearsal work?
Well, it may come as a surprise that we actually don't do sectionals like that. The closest we come, and this was something that was sort of new when Ado came on board, we will often actually have string sectionals where it'll be just the string section, say, for a morning rehearsal, and then just the winds and the brass and percussion for the afternoon rehearsal. And it allows for a certain kind of detail, level of detail and clarity to work on when you don't have all those people honking away, you know, while you're trying to play the important stuff. My colleagues know I'm joking.
Yes.
Ado is a detail guy. And I can tell you that if you have a string sectional with Ado DeVart in front of you, you are much more apt to know exactly what's going on, not only in your part, but with the person sitting next to you and the other string sections as well. To me, it's been hugely beneficial. But there's a level of transparency there that maybe some people weren't used to, especially right at the beginning. It's not that you can hide in an orchestra, but there is a certain safety in numbers philosophy that can creep in. If you're doing a Mozart symphony that's so transparent and so just crystalline in a way, that becomes more apparent when you're just doing a sectional rehearsal and there's maybe 8 or 10 of you trying to do something really complicated all at the same time, all with the same sort of stroke and dynamic level, and that's what we work on. Sometimes in a sectional rehearsal, you know, we'll do work for long periods with just the cellos, but he'll be working. He basically runs the rehearsal. Okay. Once in a while, I'll get up and maybe say one or two things to the section, but at this point, most things that need to get sorted out don't need to be verbalized. You just hear it, and the next time you play it, it happens. Or he'll work it a little bit, and everybody's clear on it.
So contrast that to Franklin music and other chamber music that you do where there isn't a conductor,
right.
and you are all having to make this, and there is no place to hide in chamber music.
Right.
Because there's usually one person on a part.
Yeah. It's a totally different thing. I wouldn't compare it to a committee, but the people that appear on my series are chosen not just for their level of musical expertise, but also because there's a certain personality that lends itself to this kind of format and that kind of series. I think any good chamber musician understands the value of compromise and exploration and creativity. And I can't think of really one instance where we've had somebody come in who didn't fit that really well. I've been really lucky that way. I also have good instincts that way. We just don't get divas, you know? And I don't do well with divas anyway. And so we get people that really play well but are willing to spend some time trying different ideas, and we expect people to have input and ideas, and we expect everybody to kind of try different things. And sometimes there's not time to really try everything out, but everybody knows that. It's a conversation, and it's just how the conversation sort of unfolds, oftentimes just in a day or two.
How's the violin?
What violin?
It's the elephant in the room, I had to ask.
I thought you had it.
Yeah. Oh, you found out. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that.
Yeah,
I've been trying to keep it well.
It back.
Yeah, okay.
It seems fine. It did have more bumps and bruises on it than we had originally detected, but nothing serious. And I'm happy that things finally seem to be moving along a little bit more on the legal front. But what a crazy, insane saga. I mean, somewhere in here, there's a Coen Brothers movie. You
know. I think there is. I think there is because, yeah. Wow, it certainly captivated the world.
Yeah. It's still really difficult for me to get my head around it. And there are still a lot of articles coming out about it and people writing stuff. But you know, where do you start with it? It's just so bizarre on so many levels, and yet probably couldn't have had a better ending in many ways, you know? I'm glad I wasn't hurt any more than I was. I'm glad that these two guys, or there were more people involved, but that only thought it through to a certain degree so that we did actually get the instrument back. I'm incredibly grateful that we had a police chief who understood the gravity of what was happening immediately and took a big risk and took a plunge, and with, I think, an appropriate result. Not predictable result, but the result that we all wanted. So, yeah, it's been an unbelievable couple months.
Yeah. Well, Frank, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Frank Uhlman is the concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra and the founder of the chamber music series Frankly Music. He spoke with me as part of a series of interviews recorded from the sixth floor of the University Club. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.